From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. Army is not all that it can be these days, not even all it needs to be. The American military's largest service, with 80% of the troops in Iraq, is having a desperately hard time attracting fresh recruits. It needs 80,000 new active duty troops to replenish its ranks in Iraq, Afghanistan, and around the world. It's not even close, and it's not alone. The U.S. Marines have been missing recruitment targets since January. Pressure on recruiters to fill quotas is soaring so high that the Army is having all its recruiters take a day off tomorrow for a so-called values stand down. Recruiters have been forgetting their ethics in their urgent need to bag recruits. But something has to be done if the U.S. military is going to fill the commitments Washington has laid out for it around the world. Now some radical new ideas are in the air to fix a desperate problem. Tonight on Point, the crisis in military recruitment. You can join the conversation 1 year from now. Who's going to fight the war? And what's the answer to the missing recruits? Is it time to crank up peer pressure, militarize the culture, make military service the price of a green card? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Damian Cave, reporter for the New York Times. He's been covering the military's mounting recruitment woes. Damian Cave, thank you for being with us tonight.
Sure, my pleasure.
And it's terrific reporting you've been doing. I wish you'd paint the big picture for us, Damian. Just how tight a spot is the military getting into on the recruitment front?
Well, I mean, the Army in particular is in a really tough spot. This year, it looks like, I mean, they started the year with barely 18% of the, knowing the names of the 18% of the people who are coming in for the year. This coming year in 2006, they're only going to have 10%. As it stands now, they are trying to get 80,000 active duty troops for the year, and they've only got about 36,000 as of the end of April. It's really difficult out there, and recruiters talk about the war being a major factor, the economy being an additional problem in terms of bringing people in when there are good jobs out there for young people. It's really a difficult case that they're in right now.
All this putting incredible pressure on recruiters in the field. Describe for us this values stand down that's occurring tomorrow. We're going to hear in a moment from the Army's top recruiter, Major General Michael Rochelle. But you've written about the values stand down day. What is it? Why is it happening tomorrow?
Well, I mean, I would defer to the general for the most part on this, but basically what it is, it's a day to step away from their daily duties to focus specifically on ethics and on how to make their mission, how to get the recruits in that they need. This is something that's very rare in terms of the recruiting command, particularly as it relates to ethics. There have been days like this when there are accidents, when there are a lot of vehicle accidents, or there was a day like this sometime in the past year because of safety concerns where there was vandalism and other problems at recruiting stations. But according to the general and other people in the military, This is the first time in the past 20 years that the Army has taken a day off from recruiting to focus specifically on the rules governing what you can and cannot do to bring people in.
Give us some examples of the kind of ethical lapses that recruiters have fallen into under the intense pressure to staff up to do what Washington is asking the military to do. What's been going on?
Well, according to the Army's own statistics, there have been everything from coercion and threats to bring people in to false promises about whether or not people can join or can join and will not be sent to Iraq. There are also a couple of extreme cases that have come to light in the past month or so, including a case that I reported on about a bipolar young man in Ohio who had been recruited a few days after he had gotten out of a psychiatric hospital. There was also a case in Colorado in which a 17-year-old young man posed as a recruit and said that he had a drug problem, said that he didn't have a high school diploma, and the recruiter, according to this young man who has a lot of this on tape, said, well, that's okay, we'll help you fake a diploma, and don't worry, we'll clean out your system of the drugs.
Damian, if we could, I've got a little bit of that tape here, which is kind of illustrative. If you can pause for just a moment, let's listen to it. This is from Colorado, 17-year-old high school honor student David McSwain wanted to see how far an Army recruiter would go to recruit him. So he created this false story that he was a high school dropout with a drug problem, two things that should have disqualified him. Then he recorded phone conversations in which Army recruiters encouraged him, as you say, Damian Cave, to forge a false diploma and take masking agents so that he would pass the drug test. Let's listen to a bit of that call.
Now, when you said about your one problem that you have, what does it consist of? Like
marijuana.
Oh, okay. Okay, so that's a major?
Yeah, well, he said he would take me down to get that stuff. I mean, I have no idea what it is, so you'd have to show me.
Okay.
I mean, is that a problem?
No, not at all, man.
There's just a bit of a recruiter under the gun to bring in recruits, doing his best to make way for marijuana use or to help mask it. Damien, you also mentioned coercion. What kind of coercion?
Well, there was a case, I think it was in Houston, yeah, it was, in which another young man had a voicemail message from a recruiter who threatened to have him arrested if he didn't show up at the recruiting station that day for an appointment that had never actually been scheduled in the first place. So that's the kind of thing that can happen in that case. There are also cases, one of the more common cases is when recruiters have someone come in, they sign the initial forms, and then tell the recruit, you can't get out of it, you've already signed up. When in fact they can get out of it up to almost the last day that they ship out.
In fairness, an awful lot is being asked of the military, and they are trying to respond. They've got to have recruits to do that. They are taking a day out tomorrow to look at all these ethical issues to reinforce the core values of the military that are supposed to be there in their recruiting. Damien Cave, if you can stand by for a moment, we're joined right now from California by Major General Michael Rochelle. He is current head of U.S. Army Recruiting Command. It's based in Fort Knox, Kentucky. He's responsible for Army active duty and reserve recruiting right across the country. He's former military assistant to Deputy Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. He joins us tonight. Major General Rochelle, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom. How are you?
We're well, and we can feel your pain. Just how hard has it become to meet your numbers?
Well, it's challenging any time you're attempting to recruit an all-volunteer force. It is especially challenging right now, I will tell you, because of the two factors that you mentioned, plus one other, which I'll highlight.
Mm-hmm.
That is,
yes.
You mentioned, of course, the state of the economy. Our relatively low unemployment figures and rising GDP growth make it very, very hard for us. Couple that with the fact that we are, for the first time in the history of the all-volunteer force, engaged in sustained war. And it's one that that not everyone recognizes the threat, and how perceptive that devious, I should say, that particular threat is. There's another factor though that
yes.
I'd like to highlight, and that's the fact that we do not right now have the support of the influencers of many of our young Americans who themselves are would-be soldiers and actually want to join the United States Army.
What do you mean by influencers, General?
Well, thank you for that for asking me. What I mean by influencers are both parents, teachers, coaches, guidance counselors, and perhaps even aunts and uncles. They view the situation as, no, let's wait and see how this is going to play out. But in point of this world situation, if you will, I tend to believe, as do many others, that it's not going to play itself out in the near term, and that we have to look at this for the long haul.
So you've got a big challenge, and you have said it is America's challenge to address, not just the military's, it's the whole country's. We should talk for a moment about some of the practical steps you've taken, including, if you could describe for us, this 15-month active duty sign-up. That's much shorter than previously. What are you offering there? Is it attractive? Is it working?
Let me go back to the statement that I did make, that it is America's challenge, because
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that's generally understood by everyone. And having been an avid WBUR listener myself back in a previous life when I was assigned as a recruiting battalion commander up in Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts.
Mm, bless you.
In the 80s and 90s. Indeed, I was an avid BUR listener.
Mm-hmm.
It is America's challenge, because the one thing that is not commonly understood is that this is all about how much volunteerism we have and are embedding in our nation's youth. It's about, and I'm not calling them unpatriotic, please don't misunderstand that,
mm-hmm.
but it's about how well we are ingraining our younger rising generations with an attitude of patriotism and service.
But isn't there a mixed message, if I may ask you, General? I mean, from the very beginning after 9/11, the message was, go about your business. Don't let yourself be, your lives be interrupted by what's happened here. On the other hand, everybody can see the military commitments that have been made, but isn't there also a kind of message that this shouldn't take over the national life?
Well, no, I don't think so at all. In fact, you're correct in terms of go about the statements that were made. Let's go about our business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was generally targeted toward the economy and what happened to our economy immediately after September the 11th. But we're engaged in something right now that is simply not going to be a short-term campaign. It's going to be a very lengthy one. And I don't believe that at any point in time were any of those messages intended to say, let's not be patriotic and let's not be concerned about our nation's welfare and become a part of it.
Do you wonder sometimes, pardon me, General, if the country is bitten off more than it can chew, if it can't get the recruits to fill the ranks to do the job?
No, I don't wonder about that. I know that we as a nation are up to this challenge and every challenge that will come to us. We just simply have to work out in our not so efficient at times, mm-hmm. but marvelously democratic way. And I salute Mr. Cave. He and I have spoken on at least two previous occasions, if not more. I think just two.
Mm-hmm.
I salute his effort to at least call attention to the challenge. You asked me about the 15-month enlistment, and it
yes.
is not new. That's a common misperception that it's brand new. In point of fact, in 2002, maybe 2003, early 2003, Senator McCain, along with another sponsor, I don't recall who the other sponsor was, and I'm embarrassed that I don't, put forth this notion of the National Call to Service enlistment option.
Mm.
And we launched that program almost immediately upon its authorization in 2003. I think it was the National Defense Authorization Act of 2003.
Is it working? It's clearly not doing enough.
Well, a little bit more background, if I may, please.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was launched in only 10 areas of the country on a test basis. And it did not necessarily take hold on that basis. And I put forth the proposal that we expand it nationwide to see if we might not be able to get a little more traction with it. The answer to your question, there have been fewer than 50 enlistments since we expanded that program on the 1st of May.
That piece not fully working, not giving you what you need right now. Major General Michael Rochelle, if you can stand by for just a moment, and Damian Cave with the New York Times. We're talking tonight about the crisis in American military recruitment and some radical suggestions to address it. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the crisis in American military recruitment and some radical suggestions to address it. You can join the conversation tonight. 1 year from now, who is going to fight the war? Major General Michael Rochelle is with us. He's head of Army recruiting. He tells Damian Kay with the New York Times, also with us, that he is facing perhaps the toughest year for recruiting since the all-volunteer force began in 1973. And now we're up to our hips in Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere else. Are you following just how serious the shortfall of military recruits has become? Have you seen the desperate recruiting practices that some Army recruiters have come to, that the Army this week is trying to rein in? And what is the answer to the missing recruits? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. General Rochelle, I know we just have you for another minute. What's the most important thing that can be done to help you meet your numbers?
Well, I would like every American to simply look around and open our eyes to what's going on in the world. Right now, America's Army is as critical to our nation's well-being as it ever has been. And I'd simply like to shift gears for just a moment, Tom, if
sure.
I may, and say that I want your listeners to know that at no point in time do we minimize the seriousness of the recruiting impropriety issues that are before us right now.
You're a straight shooter. We appreciate
those,
that.
We take those as seriously as anyone, and frankly, we feel the hurt to both our Army's values and the smear that it places on the image of our proud institution as much as anyone. We're going to look at every single one of those very, very seriously.
So there's the man in charge saying, Americans, we've been tasked, we've got a challenge, please take it seriously. Major General Michael Rochelle, head of U.S. Army Recruiting, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Tom, thank you very much, and my best to your listeners, WBUR.
Thanks very much. Damian Cave, you've talked to the recruiters, and they put the problem pretty simply. One of them told you the problem is that no one wants to join.
Yes, it's true. I mean, their issue is that many young people today are, as the general said, and it's not just their parents, concerned about what the war in Iraq might do. They're concerned for their well-being, and the risk and reward equation is different now than it was before the war. And for a lot of them, it simply doesn't add up, and they're not interested.
And so you've got analysts here saying that there's a near disastrous situation developing, that the military is going to be living month to month in terms of the new recruits it's going to bring in. They've already been bending the entrance requirements. What does it mean? Are we going to have, half-empty basic training? Are we going to have below-standard troops on the front lines?
Those are possibilities, absolutely. I mean, once the Army starts to fall short of its numbers, it becomes a cycle where if you don't make your numbers to get to training, if you don't to get to boot camp, then you have drill sergeants who are sitting around and not doing anything. Then at that point, there's not enough soldiers to get into some of these active duty units. And the, during the last recruiting shortfall, which was in the late 90s, two of the Army's 10 active duty combat units had to rate themselves at the lowest level of combat readiness because of the recruiting shortfalls then. And those were not as severe as what's going on now. So this is something that in a year from now could be a major issue.
Damien, just look over the horizon for us, if you would, a little bit. Your newspaper ran a kind of a panel with different suggestions, kind of radical suggestions, on how to fill the ranks if Americans aren't stepping up in adequate numbers right now. Can you give us a sense of the gamut of out-of-the-box ideas that are out there?
Yeah, there are actually quite a variety of interesting ideas out there. A lot of people really feel that there's a number of things that should be tried long before we even consider a draft. The boldest of these, perhaps, is to open the ranks more to both legal and illegal immigrants, to perhaps make the military somehow connected to citizenship, whether it's just for new immigrants or even for those who have been here for a while.
So you put a recruiting station on the Rio Grande and just say, if you want a green card or you want citizenship, you have to serve first.
I mean, the more likely scenario is that you would take people who have been here for long enough to have a connection to the country and to have some sort of link to it. This would both sort of handle the immigration issues as well as the military issues. Mm-hmm. Some of the other things that are out there are things like, you know, consolidate among the recruiting commands. At this point, any given high school in the country has 7 recruiters, one from each of the branches, the reserves, and the National Guard, pitching to the same students. Mm. So some people believe that it would be better to have maybe one person pitching to these students and then could direct them to whichever branch they want. That's sort of an efficiency idea.
And then there's the idea of privatizing everything except the infantry, everything except the guys with women today with triggers near them, I guess.
Right, exactly. I mean, do we really need a military male person? Do we really need, you know, to what extent do we need cooks who are in the military? Why can't that be privatized? I mean, the military has clearly done a lot of this already. The question is whether or not there's more room for that and that might be a way to lower the demands that are needed for soldiers.
And then you had Walter Russell Mead at the Council on Foreign Relations, been a guest on the show, saying use peer pressure, looking back to previous wars and saying, you know, you've got to kind of, whether it's people being afraid of feeling like cowards or afraid they're not going to get a girlfriend if they're not in uniform. This is kind of sounds extreme today in 2005, that kind of general militarization of the social culture.
Well, it may sound extreme, and yet it's also exactly what General Rochelle, to a certain extent, is calling for. He's asking that the country understand and respect and create a culture which values service and which basically makes that the norm. At this point, if you're a young person, it's rare that you may have an experience with the military, whereas in previous eras, I mean, whether it was World War II when half the class at Princeton served, whereas now it's a very small fraction. I mean, basically, we've created a situation where there's a military culture and then there's the rest of the country. And this divide is something that wasn't as intense during the Civil War, wasn't as intense during World War II, or during, you know, during World War I in England when, you know, women would pass out white feathers to young men who they believed should be serving but were not. That's exactly the kind of culture that the general believes the country needs to be moving into as we take part in this lengthy ongoing war on terror, as he said.
Boy, you talk about a culture change shift. That's a big one. Damien Kaye, please stand by. I want to welcome in a couple terrific voices here. We're joined tonight from College Park, Maryland, by David Siegel. He's director of the Center for Research on Military Organization. He's professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. David Siegel, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
And from Olympia, Washington, by David Slotwinski. He is retired U.S. Army, former chief of staff of the U.S. Army Recruiting Command. David Slotwinski, Colonel Slotwinski, thank you for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here tonight.
If I may turn to you first, Colonel, you hear Michael Rochelle now trying to do this job. It looks like a tough one. You must be glad not to be in his shoes tonight.
No, I think I was General Rochelle's chief of staff for a while before I moved on to command the military entrance processing command. Mm-hmm. And it was an honor and a pleasure to work for the general. Just an outstanding leader, officer, great friend. I do not envy his position, and he's got some great challenges.
David Siegel, how do you characterize this? We're reading here near disastrous, a kind of a maw opening up that's not being filled. How serious would you describe this shortfall being?
I think it's very serious. I, in fact, think the volunteer force is closer to being broken now than it ever has been in its 30-some-odd-year history. But I tend not to use words like disaster or crisis. It is a problem.
When you're at war and your troops are getting worn out in tough duty, very serious it sounds like the right phrase to me. So what do you do? We're looking at some radical solutions here tonight. Privatize, you know, everything but the sort of very front line. Consolidate the recruiting operations. Maybe make military service the price of a green card for legal and illegal immigrants. Crank up the peer pressure. How do you understand the young Americans out there, their mentality, their willingness, and what it might take to get them in the military?
Well, I have put forward some of those suggestions, but quite frankly, mm-hmm. I don't think the problem is the recruiting issue. I think recruiting is a symptom of a larger problem, which is a disconnect between our force structure and our national security policy. Our current military force structure was never intended to support the kinds of military operations that we're now involved in. Now, after the fact, we're trying to make it fit and we're trying to catch up, realizing, I guess, on a back burner that America has never mobilized for war the way it has recruited for peacetime. In wartime, we've taken extreme measures like instituting conscription. We have generally attempted to expand the mobilization base and expand the number of people who are available for military service. We have done that on the margins in this conflict. The reserve components have raised their enlistment age from 35 to 39 to catch that five-year group of people who may want to come in but were too old under the old limits. We're expanding ways to more deeply tap the 20% of the population who are not high school diploma graduates.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that those are all attempts at the margin to fix a bigger structural problem. I think ultimately the problem is going to have to be addressed by something like the quadrennial military review that is currently going on.
Well, I put this question to General Rochelle earlier, asking if the United States has simply bitten off more than it can chew in terms of military operations that it has underway around the world. I guess as a good military man, he has to say no, but are you saying yes, it has? That
yes,
policy-
it has. Absolutely. We have a force structure that was initially designed to support us in the Cold War with a mission of deterrence and defense. We had conscription, selective service in standby, and I think everybody in the defense manpower community understood that if there was a major war in Europe again, we were not going to fight it simply with the all-volunteer force. We were going to reinstitute conscription.
But Donald Rumsfeld just very recently saying the last thing we need is a draft. That only a couple of weeks ago.
I think that both the Secretary of Defense and the President would take that position. But if they're not going to do that, then they have to find other alternative means of expanding the mobilization base, immigrants, legal and illegal, is probably the way that will produce the largest numbers. Others, I think, will operate at the margins, but I think that something drastic will have to be done.
But immigrants, legal and illegal, pretty soon it starts to sound like almost a mercenary force, so, you know, Hessians kind of a thing.
Well, historically, we have had our wars fought largely by immigrants.
What do you mean, exactly?
For much of our history, we were a nation of immigrants, and in World War I, we had more immigrants in the U.S. Army than their percentage of the population.
And was military service specifically and explicitly the price of citizenship?
It was certainly implicitly associated with citizenship. And many political theorists have argued that military service has been more important than the franchise in linking the citizen to the state.
But Damien Cave, wouldn't it be something new? Not to say, come on over, and yes, it would be great if you served in the military, but instead say, if you want to have a green card here, the military is the way to do it. Isn't that new?
Well, the difficult thing with that aspect of it, according to, you know, some people that I've talked to, is it creates an incentive for exploitation. I mean, what if you don't enlist? Does the recruiter then turn you into immigration?
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a lot of things that would have to be worked out in order for it to work. I think that Professor Siegel is right, that it is the broadest possible solution in order to get the largest numbers. But there are some significant difficulties or hurdles that would have to be overcome to address some of the concerns that are a part of the fact that this would be, from what I understand, different. But Professor Siegel would know more about this than I would.
David Slutwinski, let me put it to you. As a military man, you can see how that might help you meet your numbers. But if you're going to be serving in the field, what do you want to be serving alongside, you know, brand new immigrants or immigrants who have been in the States for a while, but their English may not be that good? Is that a good pool to draw from for an effective fighting force?
First of all, I don't think that's a very good suggestion at all. But there are a couple other things that I would really like to make a point about.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think one is you got to go to perceptions regarding the war in Iraq. I think there's a huge disconnect at the senior level, at the elite levels of our government, about what the risk rewards are.
What do you mean?
At the upper levels, the war in Iraq is perceived as low risk to the nation, high reward.
Mm-hmm.
You can, if in fact we're successful there, we stabilize the region, you have regional peace, and long-term promotion of many of the goals and objectives of our nation.
So if you look at it that way, it looks like a great bargain.
But when you get down to the recruiter dealing with the parents,
mm-hmm.
now it becomes a complete shift in perception. The parents, I believe, see it as being high risk, low reward.
For their child.
Correct. Historically, applicant parental custodian fears and perceptions of injury or death have always ranked among the reasons for not wanting to enlist. It's always been there.
And they're not swept away with that top-level Washington
right.
view. I want to begin to bring our callers in, if I may. Ben is calling from Boston. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Glad I'm waited. Let's see here. It's very, very timely that you took my call right after the last comment that was made, because I was going to say the same thing. I myself am a young person. I'm 25.
Okay.
I'm relatively young. I'm a liberal, but I love my country, believe it or not.
I'm perfectly willing to believe. Have you considered joining one of the military services?
Well, I like to think that if it were, say, World War II, I would not hesitate to join the military because I believe in what that mission was.
And what about war on terror or war in Iraq?
Well, you can probably guess what I'm going to say, but I believe that it's not a just mission. And I believe that also, I mean, it's a tough position for the military because the military is a very, I think that it prides itself, as well it should, on being above just not having to do with politics. Military follows orders. And unfortunately, the military still has to recruit, no matter what orders are given to it.
But what are you saying, Ben? Are you saying that you or people like you aren't in there because they don't believe in Iraq? Do you think that then we should just come home from Iraq? Or if the United States is going to stay there, it's not your problem?
Well, I think that the whole thing was sort of rotten from the beginning. So yes, that's a tough position for the military, but that's my sense of things.
Just don't believe in this effort. Thank you very much for your call, Ben. David Siegel, that's a tough nut to crack if that's what the military is up against.
That's largely what the military is up against.
How do they get around that?
Well, given the nature of civil-military relations in the United States, we have a military that does not choose what wars it is going to fight. It serves as an agent of the government, and I certainly wouldn't want it any other way. On the other hand, I think that General Rochelle's suggestion that we militarize society, and by the way, I think the world of General Rochelle, I think that the stand-down for ethics and value evaluation is marvelous.
Sounds honorable.
He has one of the toughest jobs in the Army today.
No kidding.
But I think that the solution of militarizing society is exactly the wrong way to go. Society should decide what wars it will support. And if our national leadership gets us into wars that society will not support by providing its sons and daughters, that should be a very strong signal to our national leaders.
Damien Cave, I understand that perfectly well conceptually, but here we are in the middle of things. That will be no consolation to General Rochelle and the people trying to fight the war, trying to have recruits to do it.
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting is talking to a lot of these recruiters, as I have been over the past 6 months, they feel like the message of what they do and the message of the military isn't understood by the American public. And this is in part, perhaps, an advertising or a marketing problem where they don't understand that perhaps many of the people who are over in Iraq are feeding children, who are helping people there. And it is possible that, you know, that the country supports its wars based on how many people it sends over and based that this is recruiting crisis may in fact be, to a certain extent, a vote on the conflict. However, it is also a matter of communication. And a lot of these soldiers who do believe in the war believe that part of the problem is that their message and their image and their dedication is something that is in many cases foreign to a lot of the people they're talking to.
I'm thrilled to have each of you with us tonight, Damian Cave, David Siegel, David Slutwinski. Please stick with us. We're talking tonight about the crisis in American military recruitment. You can join us. Is it time for radical action? Is it time to crank up peer pressure, militarize the culture, make military service the price of a green card? And if a country can't muster a sufficient army, does it have any business being at war? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the crisis in American military recruitment and some radical suggestions to address it. The military needs 80,000 new active duty soldiers for next year. They are not even close. Army missing its monthly goals month after month. Marines, ditto. What do you think? You can join us. What about privatizing? Should everything except the military be contracted out, except the infantry? And have too many Americans been too isolated from the military obligations the country has taken on? Are most Americans in la-la land about the price of war? Or is the war the problem? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight by Damian Cave, reporter with the New York Times, David Siegel at the University of Maryland, been watching these issues for a long time, David Slutwinski, former chief of staff of the U.S. Army Recruiting Command, 2000 to 2002. And right now, from Cambridge, by David King. He is associate director of the Institute of Politics and a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, co-author of The Generation of Trust, How the U.S. Military Has Regained the Public's Confidence Since Vietnam. David King, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much. Good evening, Tom.
Good evening. So, a big problem, and it's right in front of the military. What suggestions would you make for solving it?
Well, take one quick step back. It absolutely is a big problem, and left untended will become completely untenable. But the military remains the most highly respected institution in the United States, more respected than the churches, more respected than universities, hard to believe.
And no one's laying a glove on that tonight here. On the contrary, but
yeah.
It doesn't have enough people.
No, it doesn't. And I was a little surprised by earlier comments about maybe a lack of support for the military among the general public. I think the general public is already highly militarized in many respects. Children grow up, used to seeing scenes of the military. They don't have a first-hand experience with the military, but they certainly have a virtual experience with the military.
But it's one thing to see the jazzy ads on TV or to play the video games or to put the yellow ribbon on your car, but they're not showing up at the recruiting station.
They are not showing up in as high of numbers as one certainly would want. The resistance tends, of course, to be more from parents than it does from young people. Young people are extremely service-oriented right now, and not necessarily military service, but community service. They're joining and volunteering in organizations at the highest rate we've seen since the World War II generation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They are what sociologists call sociotropic. They really are out there in the community, and I think that's something that we ought to tap into.
How would you do that?
Well, I hope that we can think in this time of recruiting crisis about taking a group like the National Guard and turning it into a service corps that would be welcoming across gender and across sexual orientation, across race.
The National Guard's fighting the war in Iraq. What do you mean by service corps?
Much of the National Guard can be deployed in ways that support democratic institution building, that provide clean water, provide food, help to build roads and schools. Much of the work of building democracy, of spreading democracy, is not done at the point of a gun, but is done with a clipboard and an open heart.
David King, do you mean you would guarantee those who joined up for the National Guard that their service would be that kind of thing, building roads, clean water, not toting a gun?
Yes, that's right.
How do you do that in Iraq, where every road-building crew is under threat of attack?
You can't do it in Iraq. And it's the kind of transformation of the military into a service culture that we need to anticipate for the next set of crises. We have a crisis right now of tremendous proportions in Darfur, 400,000 people dead and dying, the numbers going up by 5,000 every day. And it's a bit of a catastrophe. We're not there with any kind of sizable humanitarian aid. That's something that our democracy corps could be used for.
So tap into that sociotropic, that ready-to-volunteer impulse, even if it's not for the trigger hand. David King at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Let's get a call. Hugh is calling from New Bern, North Carolina. Hugh, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Good to have you.
My comment is basically that the military force that has performed in the last 3-4 years mm-hmm. has been obviously the best military force we've ever fielded, and
they clearly have a lot of support, but they're not getting their recruits. So what's to be done?
Well, why aren't we emphasizing the quality of the force we have today, the quality of the force that people could join, rather than playing the numbers game of, and all the fictitious promises of this and that?
To say you could be associated with this fine fighting force.
You betcha.
Mm-hmm. Let us pick that up, Hugh, and thank you very much for your call. David Siegel, is that the kind of appeal that would pump up the recruiting numbers, or isn't that an appeal that's already being made? I see a lot of ads on TV that make it look awfully darn jazzy.
A whole range of recruiting appeals have been used, and I think we tend to underestimate how patriotic the American people and the American youth are, and David King made this point. And through the history of the all-volunteer force, while the recruiting business has not emphasized patriotic appeals, in fact, when we survey recruits and when we survey young Americans who are thinking of joining, among the most important motivators for them are patriotic motivations. That is there. And as David King pointed out, the American people have supported the American military. And that goes, that is true, surprisingly, back to the revolution, to the Vietnam War, when the war itself was not very popular, but the military was tremendously supported by the American people.
But how do you hook that up to the numbers that are needed?
Well, that support, unfortunately, has not been translated into the people sending their sons and daughters to serve. I think that translation, the failure of that translation, is an important message that our policymakers have to look at.
Let's get another call. Wally's calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Wally. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks.
Yeah.
I think we're many years away from the time when the king led his troops into battle, and everybody supported the loyal to the king. But it seems to me that the recruiters would be much supported if the people who voted for this war would convince, as those patriotic parents we've just been talking about, those, but who unfortunately are imbued with the low risk, high reward mentality.
The people who voted for the war, meaning who
if
exactly?
Those people, if those congressmen and the president and vice president would convince their relatives, those would to sign up.
So you may remember those Michael Moore scenes of the congressman turning away from
remember Teddy Roosevelt, who lost a son in the First World War.
Yeah.
And this we've talked about the history of patriotism since the Revolutionary War. Well, in those cases, the leaders not only fought, but their families fought.
So if the war's so important,
That the leaders are behind this war, and let's get going with them.
Wally, we've got it, and thank you very much for that. If the war is so important, where are the children of the elite? Damien Cave, I don't suppose that's the way the profile of those who are signing up is tilted.
No, for the most part, they appear. I mean, most of the people who serve are middle class. They come from schools that are neither the best nor the worst in their area. And there are people who may have limited options in terms of education, but they are generally representative of the country itself. And it's not really a political thing. It's not as if you can say all Republicans send their children to war and Democrats do not. It seems to be far more complicated than that. I would like to address, though, the idea that the country has always supported the military. Talking to parents, as I've been doing a bunch this week, mm-hmm. some of the things that have come up are the, some of the things that have tarnished that image, things like the abuse scandal, things like...
You mean Abu Ghraib, like or which abuse? What abuse scandal?
The Abu Ghraib mm-hmm. scandal. I mean, these cases have just been completed, some of the trials, and right. I was surprised to hear some of these parents raising this as a concern, as, well, do I want my children to be a part of a group like that?
A nightmare to picture your child in that setting, but then there are many other settings which are far from abusive corners of dark prisons, but those get
right,
some pretty big headlines.
Absolutely. I mean, most people, like I said, I mean, the recruiters that I speak to feel as if many of their humanitarian things that they do are underestimated. And so there's clearly a divide. But among parents who are already afraid that their children are going to go and die, some of the more negative things seem to be sticking in their memory in a way that maybe they haven't in the past.
David Slutwinski, you were right in the heart of this effort before. What do you make of the level of public support of the military and why it's not translating into more volunteering?
Well, I think the level of support for the soldier and for the job that's being done on the ground in both Iraq and Afghanistan around the world is very high. One of the comments that I would make goes really to kind of the heart and soul of the advertising and how do you promote military service.
Mm-hmm.
General Rochelle hit on it. Dave Siegel hit on it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The current advertising programs basically create awareness. And the younger the youth is, generally in that 16, 18-year-old cohort, the advertisement sits very well with them, and you create mm-hmm. awareness about military services and the features and benefits. What we have never really done, and I've been in the recruiting business in and out since 81 till I retired in 04,
mm-hmm.
we've never really have looked at the thought of can we, and we being the Army or the Department of Defense, take ownership of propensity.
What does that mean?
Propensity being the desire of a young person to join the military.
But taking ownership of the what? Of the likelihood, of their inclination to join? How would one
yes.
take ownership of that? What do you mean?
It would be somewhat of a different type of advertising campaign. But there are a group of us that believe that we can influence propensity.
How?
In the attitude and belief about the nation's youth.
But isn't the advertising already trying to do that, or is there something deeper, something else you're referring to?
It's deeper. It takes a different form and approach. You have to appeal to latent, very evident, the positive, patriotic ideas that are out there, and you have to take and uncover those through some different approaches. We always wring our hands over perceptions of fear and youth and thinking that somehow we can modify the fear through ads that focus on the rational man concept. But what we never get into is the nation, not just part of us, is a war, and the commitment of your grandfathers, the greatest generation, the history, and the legacy of our nation. This is driving propensity rather than creating awareness. The current advertising creates awareness.
Mm. I think I see where you're coming to. Say to the young people of America, step into the boots of those who fought the Revolutionary War, the Civil War.
This is your challenge. This is your legacy. The war on terror is your war. The war is your future.
David Siegel, let me ask you about that. David Kang was saying earlier, and who couldn't agree, that in many ways the country is already has a fairly militaristic mindset in some respects. But David Slutwinski is saying we've got to take that a lot further if we want to meet these numbers. This sounds like a real cranking up of a kind of military attitude.
Well, it's a different kind of support, and I think it's a marvelous idea. I've done a good deal of the research on propensity with colleagues at Maryland and at the University of Michigan. It is the strongest predictor of enlistment, and if the military could, rather than simply measuring it, find some way to get leverage on it and use it as an enlistment tool, I think that would be very powerful.
But is there an issue of what kind of country we want to have, or are we trying to have it both ways here? Does that mean turning America into Sparta? Is that what's required with the terror threat?
Realistically, whether you're talking about terrorism or conventional threats, we happen to live in a world where there are nasty people out there who are willing to do nasty things to us and to our friends.
Mm.
And every nation, and particularly the major nations, have a responsibility for providing for their security. And the question is, how do you do that? It's particularly difficult in a democracy. Democracies really defend themselves with one hand tied behind their backs because they try not to become too militarized. But we can't idealistically say, well, these nasty things will go away if we stick our heads in the ground.
Yeah.
So I think the approach of, in fact, trying to take ownership of propensity
and rather than merely measuring it, use it as a tool, I think is a very sensible approach.
And yet I wonder if you really pushed on that front, if people's notions about the policy might change before the propensity changes. And we say, well, if I've got to fight, I'm not sure the war is such a good idea. Let's get one more call here. Adrian's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Adrian, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a 25-year-old from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I have had friends that I've been close to that have been in the military.
Yes.
While I have not been in the military myself.
Mm-hmm.
And my suggestion, actually, that will give a lot of ownership to a lot of people, would be to make it mandatory for everyone. And me personally, I would be willing to do that. That if everyone at 18, every single male, female, and everything in between would be required to go into basic training, and from there you'd be cut out. If you're missing a limb, if you're not 20/20 vision, if you're whatever,
right,
then you're cut out.
But everybody show up for service and expect what? What kind of term of service, Adrian?
I'm not sure. I think that would probably be best left up to people who would make that commitment.
but a year, a couple of years, and just have everyone do it. Our time is short, but I appreciate your call. Damien Cave, is that out there?
That idea is definitely out there. I mean, it's sort of the end result, I suppose, what people are looking at, the last resort, I suppose. But it's something that people like Colonel Slotwinski and some of his colleagues have been discussing at length. And it's just a question of time, some would say, but we'll see. This is a crisis mm-hmm. that is here now, and there are lots of different possible solutions. It's just a matter of whether or not which ones are tried and which ones work.
David Slotwinski, Donald Rumsfeld said very recently, the last thing we need is a draft. If it comes to it, do you agree?
I think we're still a long way from requiring a draft. I think there are lots of things that you can still do to improve the recruiting requirements. There are, the organization of the recruiting command, who the recruiting command reports to, how you resource the recruiting commands.
So mandatory service, you would not vote for mandatory service at a certain age then?
At this point in time, no. I do not see a requirement for any kind of draft. I don't see it as being a really viable alternative.
And David Siegel, do you see the all-volunteer Army as cutting it, as being a viable basis going forward with the recruitment problems we're seeing?
I do not see it viable supporting a national security policy of preemptive war. I think that we have to rethink that. I find very attractive, and always have, the notion of universal national service. And that really is the direction that Charlie Rangel was moving in when he introduced legislation for conscription. I think it's important to couch it not simply in terms of everybody doing 2 years of military service, but rather everybody doing something for the country. I think that that's important, first of all, because it would reinforce the notion that citizenship involves some responsibilities, and at the same time wouldn't burden the military with the demographics of dealing with the numbers of 18-year-olds that we produce. Right now, we recruit between 200,000 and 250,000 people into the services to man the active duty forces. Every year in the United States, about 2 million young men turn 18, another 2 million young women turn 18.
So there's a lot more out there if they could be brought in, and they may need to be. Our time is up, but David Siegel, we're very grateful to you for being with us. Thank you so much for joining us. And David Slotwinski, former commander of U.S. Military Entrance Processing, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Damien Cave with the New York Times, thank you for your reporting and for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
And thanks to David King at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government who joined us earlier. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.